Good morning, and thank you for the invitation to come and speak at Hamilton Mennonite this morning. The letter of James is a feisty little document. Someone once told me that she felt James sort of barks at people. It could be that James strikes some of us this way because we're so accustomed to a certain Canadian niceness, which would not probably have been part of James's world. James, like Jesus, and certainly Paul sometimes, is direct and speaks his mind. Although it's not easy to understand everything he says because we do not share his culture or his time, we nonetheless appreciate that he's doing his best to lay his cards on the table. Today we heard the first part of James, and as you may know, the first part often of ancient letters could function as a mini table of contents. If we were to read the entirety of James, we'd see that themes of testing, endurance, completion or integrity, as well as the criticism of the rich and the uplifting of the poor, figure very importantly later on. However, what I want to focus on, of the many things that James talks about here, is James's stress on the relationship with God, especially in times of suffering. And I thought that might be fitting given that I know you've been reflecting upon the theme of covenant during the season of Lent. James says, "If any of you is lacking in wisdom, ask God, who gives to all generously and ungrudgingly, and it will be given to you." This sounds somewhat like the Matthew 7 passage, "Ask and it will be given to you." Many interpreters think that James is indeed drawing upon some of the teachings of Jesus here, teachings that stress both the importance of asking things for things from God, as well as God's reliability. James and Jesus, it seems, have a lot in common. Then in verses 17 and 18 of what we heard today, James says that every generous act of giving, every perfect gift, is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow due to change. James evokes Greek astronomy here. Unlike the flickering stars, God remains steady. The passage ends with the declaration that God gave us birth by word of truth so that we would become a kind of first fruits of his creatures. This birth might be a reference to original creation, or more likely to the rebirth of people by the word of the gospel. They're in contrast to the words that appear just prior, which refer to desire giving birth to sin, which ultimately gives birth to death. So James is adamant that people remember their primary relationship to God. They must call upon God, ask God for wisdom, and humble themselves before God. Later on in the letter, it says, "Draw near to God, and God will draw near to you." The importance of this faithful relationship with God is foundational. This is not an easy faith. It must withstand testing and endurance. But when this faithful relationship falters, all kinds of problems can arise, including mistreatment of the poor, fighting, and war. If you read through the whole letter, or as you probably know, you'll see that James has a lot to say about these topics. So faithfulness is central to James, just as it is to many of the scriptures. But faithfulness does not preclude crying out to God, especially in the face of suffering. We encounter such cries, particularly in the Psalms, such as in the one we heard today from Psalm 13. "How long, O Lord? Will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me?" So being in relationship with God does not rule out complaint, for often it's not at all evident that God is there. Probably most of us understand what that feels like. Is anyone out there or in there? Where are you, God? Where is God in all the mess of the world? Ultimately, by the time we get to the end of this prayer, there is an expression of trust in God's steadfast love and a declaration of praise. But this reconciliation did not come about without some yelling and some complaining on the part of the psalmist. On the front of your bulletin, and as Gerald discussed earlier with the children, there's an image from the late 19th and early 20th century German artist, Käthe Kollwitz. She lived during the rapid expansion of industrialization in Europe, through the First World War, which took her son, Peter, and she died a few months before the Second World War ended. This was an artist committed to depicting the reality and desperation of the people around her. You can see this desperation, I think, in this image, Need, or sometimes called Not, and it was completed in the late 1800s. The Kaiser did not approve of her art. He called it gutter art. But her work was otherwise highly regarded by critics and the public at that time, late 19th century. She focused on the lives and struggles of the working poor, especially in Berlin. Industrialization had had devastating effects upon many, and Kollwitz does not shy away from confronting the viewer with the poverty, misery, and seeming hopelessness of the people she observed daily. Her art was a kind of protest against injustice and pernicious economic and social forces that wreaked havoc on the vulnerable. We see this in the image on the front of the bulletin. Light bathes the infant, yet the mourners are in shadow, and in the background the house appears to be ramshackle, almost like it's been turned upside down. Kollwitz forces us to confront the agony of these people. One could say she even evokes our indignation at their blatant suffering. The images imprint themselves on our minds. We can't ignore them. Although the Kaiser didn't like them, and neither did the Nazis later on, I suspect he must have been bothered by it. Apparently, she taught students who studied with her that, quote, art should grip, even shatter, the human heart. She would often draw figures with their head in their hands, despondent. A common subject is parents, especially mothers, such as the image you saw earlier of the mothers. For she regularly witnessed the agony of parents who lost children to war, to disease, and to the grind of poverty. In the latter part of her life, she produced a series of what I think are pretty terrifying drawings of mothers and children in the clutch of death. Her art is not pretty, but many find that it depicts the beauty of the human experience even amidst affliction. And she thought that the people she drew were beautiful. She admired them, and her compassion and care for her subjects, I think, comes across. Kollwitz rarely depicted biblical stories, and she claimed her art wasn't religious. Yet, in her willingness to confront the viewer with the sorrow and the horrors of human experience in a manner that arouses our compassion, she captures something sacred. These images express a certain hope in the ultimate dignity and value of human beings. Interestingly, a theologian named Michael Stober thinks her art functions as a kind of visual psalm. He says it enables and supports the practice of lament, the cathartic howling and weeping in rage, grief, and sorrow in the face of utterly destructive sorrows. In presenting the viewer with images of people in despair in a deeply sympathetic way, Kollwitz prompts us to pay attention and perhaps to cry out too, or at least to think about how we can seek greater justice in our own contexts. She doesn't try to defend God, and it could be she didn't identify with some of the prevalent theologies of her day, which stressed individual pietism, sin, and punishment. But she does defend the beauty and nobility of the human spirit. In one of her rare religious works, which is a sculpture she did, a Pietà image of Mary with her son Jesus on her lap, here we see not just the suffering of Jesus and his mother, but human suffering in general. In this sculpture, Mary appears to be whispering gentle words to Jesus. She's looking down at him while his face is lifted up towards hers and his body is wrapped by the folds of her garment. Kollwitz captures a profoundly human experience as if she's trying to connect the suffering of Mary and Jesus to that of all mothers and children. I think it's fair to say that Kollwitz, her art, is an example of crying out to God. It is a psalm. Like the psalmist, like Jesus, like James, she calls out. And this calling out means that one still has hope. Stober provides an example of the opposite case. He recounts the experience of Jean Vanier, the founder of the L'Arche community, who on one occasion visited a psychiatric hospital in which there were hundreds of children with severe disabilities. Vanier observed, "There was deadly silence. Not one of the children was crying. When they realize that nobody cares, that nobody will answer them, children no longer cry. It takes too much energy. We cry out only when there is hope that someone may hear us." The psalmist, Jesus, James, all remind us of the need to call out to God, even if it's a cry of protest. They insist upon God's reliability, although that reliability may be obscure, not at all obvious. Perhaps this is why James emphasizes the importance of testing and endurance. It's in part through a lifelong struggle, through life's difficulties and sorrows, that we deepen our relationship with God. It reminds me of a description I read not too long ago of another famous German, Dietrich Bonhoeffer. As you may know, the theologian and pastor, a member of the Confessing Church, was arrested by the Nazis because of his association with a group, the Abwehr, which was involved in the plot to assassinate Hitler. The extent of his involvement is not entirely clear, but he was imprisoned and eventually executed in 1945. An onlooker to Bonhoeffer's execution described his final moments. He said, "I saw Pastor Bonhoeffer. He was kneeling on the floor, praying fervently to God. I was most deeply moved by the way this lovable man prayed, so devout and so certain that God heard his prayer. At the place of execution, he again said a short prayer and then climbed the few steps to the gallows, brave and composed. His death ensued after a few seconds. In the almost 50 years that I worked as a doctor, I've hardly ever seen a man die so entirely submissive to the will of God." We cannot know what was going through Bonhoeffer's mind in these final moments, but he was praying. He was calling out to God, even if there was little, if any, hope of his own survival. He had endured a long period of imprisonment, ministering to his fellow inmates, and now facing death, he remains steadfast. It's humbling for me to think about this. It makes me feel a little sheepish when I think about my own doubts and struggles with faith. But what is comforting as we read the Psalms, or as we reflect on the teachings of Jesus, or consider the words of James, or gaze upon the art of Kollwitz, or imagine Bonhoeffer on his knees facing death? What is comforting is that we're not alone when we cry out against the injustices of the world, or when we call out to God and wonder where God is. This is not about feeling helpless or passively sitting and waiting for God to fix things, but in the midst of our efforts to pursue justice, to seek peace for the world, and to resist the temptation to complacency, the scriptures teach us that we need to keep asking for God's help in whatever way we can. Perhaps, for Katja Kollwitz, art truly was her means of prayer.